For WAMC News, I'm Jim Lavoulis. For most of those who stick with it for the average 6 months, fall typically marks the end of an Appalachian Trail thru-hike atop Mount Katahdin in Maine. The roughly 2,200-mile trail runs across 14 states through the woods, over mountains, and even on sidewalks. The organization charged with protecting and maintaining the route is the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. As it nears its 100th anniversary, the ATC has unveiled a new strategic plan. I spoke with Sandy Mera, the group's president and CEO, about the effort, which includes a trail-wide visitor use management program.
The increase in users across the board on the AT, and this is before COVID, represented a significant challenge for us as land managers. So we had the impact to the resource itself. We had, as visitors, the numbers increased, impact to people's experience that they were having on the trail. There would be these bubbles, particularly as it related to thru-hikers. So if there were large numbers, which continued to grow each year, large numbers of thru-hikers starting in Georgia, that first 100, 150 miles would just, you know, there could be 50, 60 people a night at a shelter site in the early part of the trail, at the early part of the season for thru-hiking. COVID has just added in even more of an urgency to us trying to figure out how to best manage the numbers of people that come to the AT. So the last time we did any kind of scientific count was quite a few years ago, and at that point it was estimated that between 2 and 3 million people each year step foot on the AT. We actually are in conversation that maybe part of this goal would be to undertake a new study to get a better and more accurate count, because I truly believe that it's much larger than that when you factor in everyday use of the trail. A lot of people step foot on the trail and don't even know that they're stepping foot on the AT. And for a trail that runs through 14 states, over 2,000 miles, with a multitude of entry points, it's tough to figure out exactly how many people are on it at any given moment. But I think with technology and other tools that we have now that we didn't have, you know, 10 years ago, we should be able to get a better handle on that. This is going to be a multi-year project. It's going to be based on best practice and science. There is a lot of work that's being done across the board in public lands on visitor use and a framework in which that has already been developed, and we're going to be working within that. So we're not reinventing the wheel, but we really see this as a critical component to us being able to manage the trail for the next 100 years. You know, we're going to be celebrating 100 years in 2025, the Conservancy. You know, that first part of our history was really on building the trail and then protecting the trail. And now we're stepping into the era where we have to be effectively managing it and managing the use of it.
And Sandy, you mentioned that the COVID-19 pandemic sort of increased the urgency for looking at the use of the trail. Is that because more people have been going out on the trail, or because of the health impacts of a pandemic on groups of hikers in the wilderness?
It's really the former. It had to do with the impact, and it's not just the AT. This is every single public land in the country, from your town parks all the way up to, you know, the Grand Canyon and everything in between, and certainly all the national scenic trails. You know, you've got millions of people that are out of school, either completely out of work or suddenly really thrust into a much more flexible remote work environment. And even with school, it continues to be in a remote kind of flexible sort of schedule. So folks are just, you know, desperate to get out and do something. And most of that is outdoor oriented. And really one of the easiest things for people to do is get out and take a walk. And so, you know, we definitely do struggle with continuing to make sure that our guidance is up to date on how to do that safely. It does seem that, you know, the science continues to say outdoor settings is the safest. It's not foolproof. And even there, if you're going to be coming into a cluster of folks, even stopping on the trail, if you can't kind of separate by the 6 feet, you probably, you know, should put a mask on if you're going to be talking to stranger hikers that you're meeting coming in the opposite direction. We continue, and in most cases with most of the land managers, the facilities remain closed, so shelters and privies, because there that does become more of a challenge to keep people safe. Shelters in particular, where even, you know, without the pandemic, you're sleeping kind of sardine style next to strangers. Privies have always represented a challenge for health. We typically go through a norovirus outbreak almost every year on the trail, which is, you know, folks picking that stuff up from the privy use and just touching surfaces at these kinds of backcountry facility spots. So we continue to offer guidance that if you're going to go out overnight, you should do it independently. You know, bring a tent, bring a hammock. If you can still, you know, camp around those areas, that's fine. But otherwise, you know, as best you can, disperse camping while also respecting, you know, don't be clearing out large swaths of corridor land to set up your tents and that sort of thing. Leave no trace has to stay into effect as well. So there's a lot to balance there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So continuing on with the trail-wide use management program, I know for through hikers and for section hikers, for certain segments of the AT, they need to get a permit to hike. Specifically, you know, one area that comes to mind is the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. Is a trail-wide permit system being considered?
I mean, that's probably part of what we'd look at. The Pacific Crest Trail, that's how they manage theirs, right? Again, partly because they have a multitude of individual resources that require their own permits. So PCT Association decided to go ahead and put together a global permit for through hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. You know, the AT, it's the original trail. It has a pretty independent spirit and culture. We do have a voluntary registration system, AT Camp, that the majority of folks have chosen to use. It's a great tool for individual hikers because you can see, and this is about like registering that you're going to be starting your through hike. You can see how many people, other people have registered for that same day and maybe can then make decisions like holding off for a day or two unless you really want to be in this huge horde of folks that are starting on the date that you had selected to begin with. And we've been able to use that tool effectively to reach out to folks during the pandemic. We just actually completed a survey asking them, those that had registered for this year, how many got off, how many stayed on, and then how many are planning on restarting their hikes next year so that we can start getting a handle on what it might look like in 21. So it's a really useful tool, and I hope that people do choose to do it, but it is voluntary. I don't know if we would ever be able to get or choose to get to a mandatory permitting system. Again, there's so many access points, it's kind of tough to, you know, you can't police it. So at any given point, somebody can step onto the trail and start hiking in one direction or another.
Yeah, I know even in the Northeast, up here in Western Massachusetts, portions of the AT are just a sidewalk. And then the sidewalk eventually ends and you head back into the woods.
Yep, exactly.
Another part of the strategic plan calls for protecting an additional 100,000 acres of AT lands in 3 years. How do you plan to accomplish that?
So we have a robust landscape protection program already underway, and a big part of that is the AT Landscape Partnership. So that brings together, probably about 35 or 40 land trusts, science-based organizations, other large trail organizations like Appalachian Mountain Club up in your area. Is a member of the partnership. And, you know, no one can protect land, even the really, really big guys, without bringing in multiple partners, both for financial support and just for kind of on the ground local connections and local relationships, which is really critical to protecting land. So we don't see where ATC specifically is going to, you know, purchase 100,000 acres as much as we'd love to be able to have the money to do that. But that what we do feel we can do well, which we've done in the past and continue to do, is we can grow partnerships, we can help broker relationships among a whole group of people that could come together around a particular parcel. We can leverage funding that we do have in-house to bring in additional funding or to help our other partners reach their funding goals in order to be able to do the bigger purchases. The other piece that we'll be doing, particularly with the passage of the Great American Outdoors Act, is really leveraging the Land and Water Conservation Fund. Now that that's permanently funded, and we're also now working to make sure that it gets funded at the maximum level moving forward, the AT has always been very competitive within that pool of funds from the federal government standpoint. And so we'll continue to work both on Capitol Hill and then at on the ground in seeing how we can use those funds to purchase parcels in high priority areas.
And finally, the Conservancy is also aiming to engage a more diverse audience for outdoor groups and in outdoor enthusiasts, like many other facets of society, that is an increasing focus. So in your mind, what is the best way to get groups who wouldn't traditionally venture out into nature to engage with the great outdoors?
So I think there's going to be a whole bunch of different ways that we have to approach that question. And first is making sure that we as an organization are representative of the people that we're trying to reach out to and attract. And we've admitted, you know, we need to work on that. We are not a very diverse organization either at the staff level or at the board level. And so a lot of what we're doing right now is really that internal work. We've developed a JEDI committee both at the board level and within the staff. We're looking at our hiring practices. We're doing a whole series of educational webinars. And right now we're doing online staff meetings and board meetings to really help people understand. It's sort of like, you know, you're inviting people into your home, and the first step is that you have to have the table set to be welcoming to them. So we feel that that's a really important first step. In addition to that, and concurrent with it, though, is continuing on, particularly as with our youth programming. So for quite a few years, we've been doing these youth summits up and down the AT. We're continuing those programs, looking at ways that we can do it online and virtually right now through COVID, but continuing those activities so that we can bring younger people in. We also have what we call our Next Gen Council. This is an advisory group to the organization and to the board from 31 years and younger. You know, so they just by virtue of their generation brings more diversity to our volunteer corps. We are working with them to, you know, figure out what's the best way to increase use across the board. But I'll tell you the other thing that really needs to happen, and this is really critical. You know, we've been doing recently been a lot more active on social media about the criticality of outdoor recreation, period, really, in recognizing that traditionally it has not been a welcoming space for people of color, or anyone who comes from, you know, who doesn't necessarily have the financial wherewithal to really enjoy the recreational aspects of the outdoors. And it's just disheartening to me to see people, really core supporters within the community, refuse to listen to other stories of people of color's experience, their perspective on what it feels like to be in a very small minority out and trying to enjoy the resource. And, you know, to have fellow hikers sort of disavow a person's own personal story and tell someone your experience is not valid because I haven't experienced it, that has to change. And until that changes, no matter what we do as an organization, it's only going to go so far. So anytime, you know, I have the opportunity, and we're going to continue to share stories. And if people call us up and say, you know, I'm going to drop your membership, I'm really going to say, okay, you know, we're probably not the right place for you if you really can't see the value in listening to these stories and learn from it. And so as much as every organization needs to do work, individuals out there need to do a hard look at themselves as well and do better to open themselves up to the idea that, you know, their own experience is not necessarily reflective of someone else's.
Sandy Mera is the president and CEO of the Appalachian Trail Conservancy based in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. Sandy, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it.